Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another episode of Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with award-winning film and television director Michael Apted about his unique documentary series, which began in 1964 with 7 Up and returns to theaters this month with the 9th installment, 63 Up. And you can learn more and watch the trailer at 63UpFilm, all one word, 63UpFilm.com. After a 3-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most other podcast sites, as well as at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Reviewing 56 Up, the film that came out 7 years ago, the last installment of the series that he lived to see, Roger Ebert wrote, "In one of my several reviews of the Up documentaries, I referred to the series as the noblest project in cinema history. I'm older now and might refrain from such hyperbole, but we are all older now, and this series proves it in a most deeply moving way." And he ends the review with these words, "It is a mystery, this business of life. I can't think of any cinematic undertaking that allows us to realize that more deeply." The original 7-Up was broadcast as a one-off World in Action special in the UK, inspired by the founding editor Tim Hewitt's passionate interest in the Jesuit saying, "Give me the child until he is seven, and I will give you the man," as well as his anger at the role of social class in England. 7-Up featured the children talking about their hopes and dreams for the future, and the result was groundbreaking, and the follow-up films every 7 years have won numerous awards. Michael Apted, who took over as director on 14 Up, or 7 plus 7, has returned every 7 years to chart the children's progress through life. Over 6 decades, the films have documented the group as they became adults and entered middle age, dealing with everything life has thrown at them in between. Some wonder, will 63 Up be the last? Michael Apted began his career in British television. He was 22 when he participated in the initial installment of what became the Up series. After winning British Academy Awards for early television work, he turned to features and moved to Los Angeles in the late 70s. His films include Coal Miner's Daughter, The World Is Not Enough, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Nell, and Gorillas in the Mist. He has continued to work in television and documentary as well, and served 3 terms as president of the Directors Guild of America. Welcome, Michael Apted, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you. Good to be here. I remember this room.
Yes, before we went on the air, he said he spent his first 7 years in Hollywood at Universal Studios, which is maybe half a mile from here.
The most.
Yeah. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, December 3rd. Now, it's interesting. I always like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we end up talking about. And so my first question almost every time is, can you talk briefly about your path to the work you do today? Now, with this series as the subject, kind of people's path is kind of what we're up to. But in terms of, you know, what you aim to do, early mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing, just to get people a feel for you.
Yeah, I wanted desperately to get into television or films or whatever. And this was in 1963 when I came out of college. And my big break was that I was asked to go and join Granada Television, which is in Manchester. There were 6 of us, and there we were. Now, it was a very, very famous company, a very ambitious company.
And this was just soon after the BBC had lost its stranglehold on television, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, then Granada took it over. I always thought, because I went to work for the BBC a bit after all this, but I just felt there was a kind of slight arrogance about the BBC, who thought they owned the, you know, owned the whole, as it were, field of play, and they didn't. Granada Television was owned by the family, the Bernstein family, and they just kind of decided to, you know, broaden out and be not so much middle class, no so much, you know, people who just popular stuff and whatever. And, you know, they wanted to start the whole thing again in a way. And they, Current Affairs became one of the things that they did start again, like having general elections on television and whatever. But one tiny thing, and this was a tiny thing, was the fact is that people, real, honest, working, hard people, didn't really have any airtime to talk about it. It was all about, you know, the upper class who were, you know, could maybe afford to run for parliament, but on the whole didn't have the time or the interest or the education to do it. And this particular series, which is still going on after 1964, really, well, broke that barrier, because what the film is about is comparing the different social classes in Great Britain and how the young people who joined those one, how they achieve. And of course, this was, I mean, no one knew what was going to happen. I didn't know what was going to happen. It just seemed fair enough. But it absolutely went berserk, because it was the first time, really, that what we'll call the working class or the lower middle class actually got a voice on the radio, on television, whatever. And it went through the roof. But following that, it had a very strange career, because that was 1964, and that was that.
Yeah, let me say one thing. It's like now we look at it and we think what's unique, what's groundbreaking and so on is the repetition, visiting back and forth. But what you're saying is that in the UK, the very first installment with no projection of a future also was groundbreaking.
Yeah, no, it was. As I said, by what it was discussing, the world of the working class.
On an equal footing.
On an equal footing, yeah. There was people from higher classes in a sense of money and whatever, but basically, you know, the working class were represented in this, which had never happened before.
Yeah. You were only 15 years older than the seven-year-olds who were interviewed in 64. And it may have seemed like a lot of years then, but over the years it's gotten a lot less, hasn't it? could you imagine, as you were this 22-year-old or 7 years later, this 29-year-old, could you imagine being on the other end of this project, being one of them?
Well, I was middle class. You know, I wasn't, my family wasn't poor. I mean, they weren't rich, but they weren't poor. And in a sense, they were part of the Brave New World, because instead of going on holidays or having expensive meals, they put the family through education. And so although, you know, my father had a good job in an insurance company, you know, he made sure that the three children he had a decent education, which in those days pretty much had to be paid for. And so my family, particularly also my mother, was quite political. I mean, she was not able to be a politician. That was kind of completely unheard of. But she was very interested in it. And we had a left-wing paper show up every day. And that particular thing stayed with me. And so, and because I liked the way that she saw the society, that it wasn't just the top and the bottom, the rich and the poor. It's people who had had opportunism and people who hadn't had opportunities. And, you know, she and my father were absolutely determined, at cost to themselves, to make sure that our little family did have opportunities. Whether we were lucky enough to achieve anything with it was up to us. But nonetheless, we were sent to good schools and all this, and given a real chance to do well.
Mm-hmm. Neither one of your parents went to university?
No.
And both you and your siblings did?
My sister didn't, but my brother did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The film's press materials, and I quoted it in the intro, that the project was inspired by Tim Hewitt's passionate interest in this Jesuit saying that give me the child until he is seven, I'll give you the man. And his anger at the social class in England. Who was Tim Hewitt? He's the founding editor of the program World in Action. But yeah. Who is he? What kind of guy is he?
He was a brilliant journalist. He was Australian. He lived and worked in Australia. He created a great stir in Australia. And so the Bernstein brothers, who had invented Granada, pulled him over from Australia to London, Manchester, to do the same thing there, so to really make working class who, you know, was interested in the working classes and was prepared to talk to them and take what was going on and how badly they were treated, how poor the education system was, if they didn't have money at home. You know, and so that was it. That's what he brought to it. And, you know, the history of it was very bizarre because it was, we were only going to do one because I think everybody was pretty, you know, frightened of what might happen. You know, I'm not being abusive, but I mean, lots of, you know, the very left-wing people might come on who otherwise were in the streets selling papers and, you know, and Granada was a very potent. They had a very good drama department, very good pop music department. Everything, they didn't do that many things, but everything they did was really good. But this was a bit more dangerous, you know. But what was so weird about it is a Canadian director, Paul Armand, mm-hmm. who was a drama director. And he was on a kind of short contract at Granada. And they asked him, he did a couple of big dramas. They said, why don't you do this for us? And he said, well, yes, I will. And then they put me with him. And I mean, I was very smart with all this, I'm ashamed to say, because I knew he didn't know anything about it. But I didn't keep telling him that. I was very helpful, very quiet and things, but the studio knew what was going on. I was, as I said, I was only 22. And, you know, I had a good instinct about what the program was about, which was I wasn't a kind of a Marxist coming in and singing and bagging things and whatever that, but I was very much because of my upbringing to see how important the country has educational opportunities for everybody. Took decades to achieve it, mm-hmm. but that's what mm-hmm. it was about. And so that's what I responded to.
So you have an Australian running the company and a Canadian running the film, and yeah. this is so essentially British.
Yeah.
This is British children, British society, which actually gave a 22-year-old like you
yeah.
more influence
yeah.
than you might have had.
Yeah.
You, let me see. I know that you had a hand. Well, wait, before I get to that, I wanted to ask this thing I said in the intro that that Jesuit saying was one of the driving forces.
Yeah.
What do you think the Jesuits meant by that?
Oh, my God. Give me a child until he is seven and I will show you the man. So I think what they're saying is start educating people when they're young before their parents start sending them out to make money and all that sort of stuff, that there's something incredibly valuable in, you know, in a very young child. I mean, not a three-year-old, but that. But Granada saw that this kind of breeding starts very young with people. You don't wait till they go to university and all this kind of stuff, because all the damage, as it were, has done by that. And of course, you know, only a very small element of the society went to
university.
Yeah.
Do you think that Hewitt believed that you could see it, or was this an experiment to test it?
No, I think he knew it, because and also Australia was much better equipped. I mean, they came much later, really, to the whole business of competition in public television and private television. When he first came over, he was 24, and he was editor of the Daily Express, which is one of the great
At 24?
Yeah, that's right.
This guy was a wonder kid.
He was. He really was a wonder kid. He was big and noisy and whatever. And he had
a sense of the people's pulse.
Absolutely. And he didn't care who knew it. I mean, whereas the English tend to be very kind of quiet, and Australians will, you know, pull the nation down, and you know, in a way like that.
Well, it's funny when we think about it that Rupert Murdoch obviously has had that influence ever since.
Yeah. And I think it's because, you know, England had, eight centuries of a class system which ran the company, whether they were, you know, on horses and things like this. But Australia was a country of immigrants, you know, the natives of that. They sort of grew up, you know, as without any deep intellectual history. Whereas in England, the history of education was terrifying.
Yeah.
When you think how quickly the upper class got their necks around the money of education,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
how powerful education is, but they were using it just for their own class. It was very, very expensive and all this kind of stuff. And the working class, which was pretty heavy because of, you know, there were lots of ways of making money in England. There's, you know, lots of natural things there.
Resources and trade.
Yeah. So, you know, they did all the dirty work forever until really the 20th century, when they began to get some sense of equality.
Right.
They were entitled to things, but the Australians were never quite burdened with that, because they were all, and a lot of them were people who were thrown out of England or left England because they couldn't get any decent work, and any right person, you know, could see that there was opportunity in places like Canada and
Australia and the U.S.
Exactly. So, you know, that it was much harder, I think, to get status in England than it was to in the...
Yeah, if you didn't have it, it was hard to get.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you helped choose the children, correct? Again, because we've got a Canadian who doesn't know England that well. So you helped choose the children. What did that feel like to you at the time?
Well, the whole thing was a strange journey, because what I've indicated to you wasn't in anybody's head, really, that we're going to do all this. And no one ever thought it would be more than one episode. They thought, well, this would be fun, and we'll see what happened. But it turned out, you know, to be incredibly popular, because it was done sort of seriously. But it left us in a really difficult position, because it wasn't till 5 years after this first one had broadcast.
And was a huge hit.
And
great.
Ridiculous.
Just popular, but also lots of comment.
Anyway, nothing happened. And then 5 years after, I was summoned up to the management at Granada in Manchester. And they said, we want to do another of the 7-Ups. We want to see what's happened to this lot of 7-Ups and see if it's had any mark on society. Would you be interested in doing it? And I said yes before you could say yes, if you know.
And you're only 27 at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. But, I mean, I, there are 6 of us taken in from, again, it was sort of very to do with people who had decent educations already. They weren't picking people up, you know, out of the gutter to do it. They were looking for people in universities who had a broader vision of the world, even if we were only 21 or 22.
Right. the question that I asked before that I want to ask again is choosing the children, which, of course, at that point you thought right. was for a special. You know, we want, I mean, what yeah. I'm thinking of is back on the U.S. at the time, yeah. Art Linkletter had a show, Kids Say the Darndest Things.
There you go.
You may remember. And it was just the very nature of little kids and how they see the world
yeah.
was of interest. But you're choosing these children, I'm guessing, because of there was this clear demarcation of the working class and the upper class to reflect that conflict or that question. But you also didn't end up with anyone in the middle class.
No. No, we didn't. But, I mean, we really didn't know what we were doing. I mean, we realized that the English sort of class structure was ludicrous, that only a tiny set of people got into power positions of
power. Of real power.
Yeah, no, it doesn't have to be politics, but, you know, whatever. So in a way, we had no idea what we're doing, except we had our Australian set on our backs, and so obviously we knew that was poverty all over England, and it wasn't difficult really to go into that part of Great Britain and pick away people who could be useful.
But and what you were looking at, I think, and that's why I referred to that American program, was kids who were talkative, kids
yeah,
who were
yeah,
you thought would not shy away from the
yes.
camera.
But more than that, there was no idea to do anything more than the one.
Right. So that's all you needed was kids who'd be good on camera once.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, at the end, I think the first episode probably had 20 children in it.
Ah.
Because, you know, we were just making one point that a certain number of people in the certain classes don't get a choice or chance to do anything.
So I haven't gone back and seen 7, the original. Did you feature 20 or did you shoot 20 and just use the 14?
No, because, I mean, we just thought it was going to be a one-off film, and the people that said interesting things and all that sort of stuff were in it, and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, as I said, 5 years for them to come around and think, well, why don't we do another one?
Right.
And when you look at it now, you think, my God, why didn't they think of that immediately?
Of course, of course.
And why didn't I think about it? It's crazy, absolute craze.
Let me see. Looking back, would you have, if you knew, which of course you didn't, that this was this long-term unique project, more women? More girls, more little girls?
Oh, yes. But, I mean, that was more complex than class, you know, that men ran society, even if they were ignorant, as you know. Women, bloody well, fed the family. You know, if there were big families, then they tried to earn a bit of money for the families as well. But, you know, they had no real rights to go out and make money. That was the, you know, that was in a very general way, that was the man's position, you know, since time began. That when you were chasing dinosaurs or something like that, it was the men that were doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
So, and then of course, the good thing about that was as soon as this film came out, it was a riot, you know, not in a, not even an ugly riot, but oh my God.
Excitement.
Yeah, so, you know, so things went very quickly. You know, we decided, or we were asked to do one after 7 years, to do it again quickly. So cash in on it. Don't let other people cash in on it.
Right.
This is a good idea, we think. And we've got a young man there who was very helpful with the one who's still.
Still working for us.
Still working for us. And but that's the other part of the story, because I did want to do it, but I didn't want it to be my life. I wanted to do, my dream was to come to America and make movies. That was my dream. And when they asked me to do it, I didn't say it out loud, but I've said it to myself, you know, that, I mean, I'll do this and see what happens, but really, I want to get out of England and go to America. where all the stuff was happening. You know?
Especially at that time. The 70s were a great time for films.
Fantastic, yeah,
in America.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. When someone like yourself could come and...
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah, basically, yes. There was different qualities of work. I mean, with us, there was not much money, so there had to be more thinking, whereas in America, there was a lot of money, and people there could be extravagant with it, you know, and kind of make up huge new elements in popular television.
And film. You also contributed to the interviews in the original one, right?
Yes.
Not just the helping with this. Again, we're talking about this 22-year-old Michael Apted,
yeah.
but you helped. And let me tell people, by the way, that this is Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with award-winning film and television director Michael Apted, and we're talking about the unique documentary series, which began in 1964 with 7 Up, and returns to theaters this month with the 9th installment, 63 Up. And you can learn more and watch the trailer at 63upfilm.com. 63upfilm, all one word, .com. But you had a hand in some of the early questions. Again, not knowing that the template that you laid in 64 might be with you for
forever.
Decades. Yes, forever.
No, absolutely. I mean, I knew what it should be like. I mean, I didn't know that it was going to turn out to what it did, but I knew we were trying to give the working classes an examination, if you like, you know, to see how they responded to school, how much they learned at home, blah, blah, all that sort of stuff. We knew that's what we had to do, and we had no idea how it would work out. But it did work out quite well because... You know, we did split the completely ridiculous way. We did break the class down a bit. I mean, we had, as you know, 4 women and 10 men. So that was a big kick up the backside eventually.
Yeah, that you could never really fix.
No, I could fix it because what I did was start bringing the wives of
That's right.
And it tended, I think this is rubbish, but I'll say it, I think that the brighter guys and all that sort of, you know, were more likely to get married and get jobs and all that sort of thing. So I think, but we didn't necessarily want to go to kids who, you know, were at Cambridge or something like that, you know, younger men who were in the society, as it were. And, you know, we had a chance that they would have married someone in that same sort of class, which is what happened.
Of course,
so
back then.
Over the first 3 episodes, I started picking out women, you know, who suited it.
So there just could be more screen time, more voices of women.
Yes,
even though you only had the 4. I hate to do this to you, and don't feel...
No, you don't. You love it. I can see that. Go on.
But I'd like to, if you can, this evolution. You've begun to talk about it a bit, like bringing in the wives, going more to close-ups. I've seen that you realized that was going to be powerful. In the article, which I recommend to folks, New York Times Magazine, November 27th, Gideon Lewis Krause does a long article, very exhaustive. I think it offers a lot to people who are going to see it. But he really does go, well, okay, 7 it was like this, 14 was like this, 21. Just, I don't expect you to go one after another, but just some of the things that you know happened as it evolved over time.
Well, things occurred to us as we were going along, you know, that women were very, very good. But how do I get them into the program? I can't start new people. Because it was so powerful to have these...
The continuity.
Yeah. And so we understood that. And then also then we understood that with women, we had to take a lot of trouble to make sure that the women we choose were mainly from, not really from the working class, but get a tiny bit of mixture. So there was Sue, who was quite posh and in a primary school and all that sort of stuff. So we had to be very careful with it, that it didn't look like we were kind of sabotaging the whole thing.
One other thing that, for instance, in this evolution, in 7, 14, and 21, the documentary is divided into issues, sort of, politics, relationship, right, those sorts of things. And in 28, you shifted to a chapter for each child, although they're not children at that point, no. They're 28. What do you call them? I mean, it's so funny. When I was writing these questions, I wrote subjects. I mean, what are they? They're members of your big old 63-up family, I guess.
That's right.
but this switch to a chapter for each interviewee, what brought that about and what did that give you?
Well, there was a huge amount of material in there. And, you know, some children gave us, or some 21-year-olds gave us one thing and boom, 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 and other and all that sort of thing. So we felt that we should have at least two episodes every seventh year. And so that gave us a way of getting to a bigger, wider lot of people. We could go to more places to find people because we had places we could fill. You know, if we had a young married couple and the wife was great and we wanted her and the husband wasn't so great but we still wanted to keep him, you know, we had a bigger pool to go from. And, you know, that was huge help.
But this thing that I mentioned about, once it became a chapter about each person, it seems now looking back that's so obvious, but I do understand that it wouldn't have made sense on the first or second, perhaps.
No.
But it's been with us now since 28.
Yeah.
Now, you have worked. One thing that I was struck by was your cameraman, George Jesse Turner, your sound engineer, Nick Steer, have been with you since 21 up. That's 42 years. And your producer and collaborator, Claire Lewis, since 28 up, 35 years.
Yeah.
I mean, those records are amazing. What has that been like on your side of the camera?
Wonderful. No, I mean, because for two things. One, I didn't want to be all over these people every year of the 7 years. I personally refused to go and see them. Because I didn't want to get stale with it, or I didn't get too much information about it, because what's happened in year seven of every version, if you put that seven times, you have a nervous breakdown, and it will become completely unhandleable. That's not a very good word, is it? It just didn't work if we had so much material. That, you know, I limited myself to the most recent material, and of course I did some, you know, that happened earlier in the seventh.
If there was a marriage or something big, you might shoot it.
Yeah.
But that would almost be B-roll.
Yes.
But the actual interviews only happened in the seventh year.
Yeah. So that really, it was a way, because we knew we had to expand it, but we couldn't expand it by bringing new people in unless they were intimately involved with the thing.
Right.
You know,
that
was a no-brainer, because, you know, we started out with four and we had to, and we, I think, ended up not quite 50-50, but in that.
Yeah, because as I say, when I read in one of these articles that there were only four women, I was surprised because it hadn't felt that way to me. Now, when did, I mentioned the first time that I saw it, or the first time it came across the ocean, you originally felt that it was too British to work anywhere else. Mm-hmm. When did you start getting the feedback that this was very popular in other countries?
Yeah, well, I started to work in America around the time I just finished, the second film.
Right.
So I was sort of immersed in American society, and then I could see that it wasn't any different what was going on in England and the United States. I mean, it was the same kind of route they took. You know, then we suggested, why don't we bring people in. And then, you know, you say when we did 14, there was a couple of friends around or something like that who were great. And you thought, well, we have to keep them. We have to keep them.
And dogs.
And please, every film I do has got Phil dogs in it.
And you have said that there was a certain point at which you realized you weren't making any longer that political film about
yes.
class.
Yeah.
How did that shift happen for
because
you?
Because people, some people really didn't understand class enough to be able to be philosophical about it and whatever, but they could be philosophical about how much it cost and how difficult it was, you know, to put food on the table. And, you know, if we wanted an education for the kids, there was no way we could get it. When you saw their lives beginning to unroll without, you know, without the business of having things done for you, if you've grown up in a terrible environment, you know, you had a terrible school on you know, it would happen that way.
And but what I sense, and some in what I've read in interviews you've done and also in watching them over the years, is that the political differences, the class differences sort of recede.
Yeah.
And the shared humanity,
yeah.
that rich or poor.
Well, yeah, but I think that's answerable. It's because, you know, the Labour Party began to change itself. And middle-class people, it wasn't just workmen banging things into the ground and all that. I mean, politics became, as education became a bit wider, then so the social range of the choice of people grew wider. And so what we were doing is just, in a kind of nifty way, was just saying to people, this is what the country's like now. Because this boy's got a working class accent, he doesn't necessarily have to be in a you know, working class school and all that. You know, we were a tiny percent of any, you know, bringing that to the nation as a whole, although millions of people watched it. But nonetheless, you know, you could see that this piece of entertainment. And I never wanted it not to be entertaining. I didn't want to turn it into a party political broadcast, which is why I kept off politics a bit. Because then I didn't want the poorer people who wouldn't know so much about politics probably embarrassed with all these people from public schools telling us we've had 7 prime ministers from... And all that
blah,
kind of
blah,
stuff.
Yes. Yeah. No, one of the things I noticed was, looking at 63 up, you asked about Brexit of two or three or four.
Yeah.
Trump, I think, is mentioned, but there's very little of the sort of daily politics. You talk about politics in the broad sense,
I
had was, do they come up in interviews and just not end up on screen, or?
Well, no, there was nothing happening. I mean... It just drove me mad. I mean, I started preparing it in 2018, and there ahead of us, like a great big fat plum, was, you know,
Brexit.
And I thought, this is going to be great because we're going to have the whole country fiddling, be talking in terms of class. Perfect for us. And then you could see, oh my God, nothing's happening. No one knows what to do. Nobody knows what to do. And you have people with huge degrees, you know, wanting to do working class things or vice versa or everything. But there was no coherent politics going on. No one knew. Whether you were aristocrat or a coal miner, you had no idea what these people were talking about. And never did. I mean, and they gave me a bit more money in case it changed in the last minute because I couldn't put one out.
Right. No, I get it. That on the one hand, nothing's happening.
Yeah.
But then if something does happen, it changes everything
exactly,
in a way.
Exactly.
So you had a little extra, you had a fudge factor in case you had to go back and reshoot.
Yeah, it was a nightmare. Everybody
and then, of
understood
course,
it.
True to the situation, nothing changed.
Nothing changed. And it was better like that, if you know what I mean. And they all moaned about that. And they, you know, made, you know, they took the piss out of it. They were irritated by it.
The interviewees?
Yes.
Yeah.
They're irritated.
You mean, oh, I see what you're saying, is that rich or poor, Labour or Tory, everyone was pissed.
Yeah. Do something. We all know what we wanted to do, but no one was seemed capable of doing it. And it was very, you know, I had, you know, I had how many days if they vote on, they only had to vote on it, it would be something.
They didn't even
every,
do that.
Every week went by. I started shooting in August and I finished shooting in March.
Of 2019.
Yeah. So I had all those months. I had the money. I had people who I knew what they were going to say. I was prepared for it. So as it dragged on and on, nothing happened. The people in the middle of it seemed to be more and more absurd. And I don't mean the general public. The people who were running it seemed to be absurd. I don't want to do that. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
So it was, I was having a heart attack because this didn't, because I thought this would be a great way of telling the country's made its mind up. It's going to be Tory.
Yep.
It's going to be working class. We're there.
Not in 63 up. Let me ask you an out of left field question. What did you think of Richard Linklater's Boyhood?
Well, that was funny because he said, I want you to come and see it because I know him. You know, I know him, and I went to see him, and we watched it. No one had seen it. And I said, we sat together alone in a cinema, and we sat together. He said, well, I said, I think it's very good. And I said, do you have any advice for me? And I said, I only have one piece of advice. Keep going. Because that was the brilliant thing, unwittingly, I knew. I kept going. And I really gave him a hard time when he didn't keep going. Because I know that the best stuff in mine is the stuff when you see people changing and like that.
Couldn't he still in the future?
Well, I mean, I have no idea.
I mean, you didn't know 2 years after that you'd keep going.
No, I mean, I knew it was possible, but I didn't think it was going to be possible that the company would put more money.
Yeah, to keep in it. And I know that you had to round people up. Neil.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
At one point, Claire, your producer, she said it took her 3 months to find Neil.
Yeah, no.
for this one or for 56?
Just for this one. It's always been tough to find because I think he kind of enjoys that. But we've always, at the end of the day, he always shows up. But I just said to him, this will get better and better and better. That you've got a decent choice. It covers, you know, a good ground. And you can imagine what these people are going to be like in 20 years, because that's what it's about.
Yeah. But I mean, he still can.
He hasn't done it. I mean,
he did it with Before Sunset and, you know, Sunrise and those three. He might. Yeah. I just wanted to know what your sense of
that. Well, you hear it from the horse's mouth.
Yes.
He's such a nice man and such a clever guy.
Oh.
I mean, I don't think I've even seen him since, but I couldn't understand why he didn't do it. He was well-placed. Whoever he was doing it in America was a farce for us. It wasn't doable in America because...
Well, wait. I think you're answering a question I haven't asked yet, which is, was this ever proposed to do a 7-Up in the U.S.? Because
yes.
I would love to able to watch the two of them.
We did it. We did two.
No kidding.
Yes.
What are they? And I'll go see them.
Well, they were terrible.
Oh.
Well, I mean, if you look at them.
And they did, were they 7 and 14?
Yeah. Two big things here. One was American TV is just business. You know, that they don't have a real soul for anything. We do. And God bless us. We do. And that's what my argument with Mr. Hura, our friend who didn't do it. I said, people will put money into this because if you live with it and you do get two done and there you see a change, you'll get money. You have something exciting going on, something...
Something unique that people are always looking for.
And, you know, that's led me to lots of thought because as I understand it, only three countries have kept it on. I suspect...
Oh, this is good. This is what I was going to... Were there other countries that did it? So
there was lots of countries that started it.
With a 7 and a 14?
Not necessarily a 14.
Oh. So there's many that did the 7.
Yeah, a lot of people took it up. Only two countries are still doing it. You never guess in 1,000 years what they were, but
In addition to the UK?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Russia and South Africa.
Wow. Oh, South Africa must be fascinating. Well, both of them.
Well, they're both going.
And when did they start?
Oh, I mean, a good deal after me. So I would think that they're both around the 35 area.
At this point?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and America, you say, did too. And they were terrible because?
Because the great thing that we had at Granada was the management loved it. The money was there even now. But in America, it's a business. People come and go and all that sort of stuff. And there is no real sense of a corporate continuity in it. Nowhere.
So the way, as I pointed out, that you, your producer, your cinematographer, your sound engineer have been together 28, 35 years, you're saying in the U.S. that'd be much more, less likely.
We did two.
You were involved in the U.S. once.
Well, yes. I mean, I wanted to help. I wasn't going to do it, but I wanted to be aboard, you know, because everybody, they liked it in America.
Yeah.
But when CBS, who did the first one, weren't interested...
After the first one?
After the first, they did two. And I think maybe NBC did two, but I'll probably be done for blasphemy here.
And if I wanted to look those up and see if they're available anywhere,
I'll find out.
Would they be called 7-Up? Would they be called?
Yeah, it was called 7-Up in America, 7-Up in Russia and everything.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And, you know, the ones that did continue, i.e.
Russia and South Africa.
Were great. Because you can imagine there was something, and what is so wonderful about them, which is why it was insane not to do it, was this is about real things.
Right.
A huge country that was being trashed for thousands of years, you know, and obviously South Africa, which had this terrible blur on its culture and everything. And it contained to me one of the most remarkable things. South Africa was one of the countries that didn't want to do it. After they'd done the two, they didn't want to do it. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's much more difficult. We live in a country, America lives in a country which has a serious freedom of speech. But maybe South Africa didn't want to be pissed upon by the rest of the world.
But did they continue?
No.
So they did how many?
Two.
They only did two, South Africa.
Yeah, and I the history there and the current history in there is staggering.
And the change.
Yes.
To deal with.
Yeah.
And Russia is still doing theirs.
Russia is still doing it. It's very good.
Wow.
They've got a very good Russian filmmaker, and he's keeping it going, and it is fascinating.
Did you ever go back to do another set of 7-year-olds?
Well, I helped them with all of them.
In these other countries, but not in the UK. In other words, I was wondering if there was ever a second.
Yeah, I had phone calls from people who came here to talk to me about it. I mean, not tons of that, but people showed an interest in doing it, did one, did two, whatever, and then suddenly, bang, and the BBC too. The BBC wouldn't take it on.
Mm-hmm.
Because they thought, if we didn't do it first, we don't want to do it. But that's ludicrous.
Yes, of course.
Ludicrous.
Of course. Two last questions. One, you have your whole career gone back and forth between documentary and narrative film.
Yes.
How do the two influence?
Well, I've turned it into a very active thing for me because, I mean, I had two great loves, which was drama and documentary. And I didn't have much interest in fantasy drama, and, you know, nor did I have much, you know, interest in cheesy real real life and all this kind of stuff.
Cheesy reality television,
You know, which is like the classic one, because my team had an absolute nightmare when the BBC or someone, you know, what was that, the first big came out in the early, when we were doing 40.
Survivor?
Even crasser than that.
Big Brother?
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, really crass.
Yeah.
Everybody lost faith in it.
In reality television, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, I mean, that sort of television made a fortune. Fortune. It lasted probably, you'd be surprised, about 15, 20 years.
They're still making a fortune.
Huh?
Watching people buy houses and cook food. But documentaries having a resurgence.
Yeah, I know, which is great. I'm thrilled about that. I mean, I've always pushed it, always tried to persuade other countries to do it and all that sort of thing, because the more you do, the more intriguing it is.
Here's finally the last question. Is 63 up the last one?
Could be. Only...
What would be the...
Reason?
What are the factors that will influence whether there is a 70 up?
One is, I know the company would make it. If I didn't make it, well, you know, maybe they didn't want to trust it to someone else, but I can't believe that. I think they would do that. My problem is health. You know, I'm not in very good health. And I can't believe that in 7 years I'll be in any
7 years from now that you could carry that load. Yeah.
Because I don't want to screw it up. Or maybe I could take a more executive voice in it, because I'm sure, I mean, everybody wants to do it. The people want to do it, you know, the studios.
Even the ones who say they don't want to do it want to do
it. Well, sort of, yeah, sort of. But anyway, so that's the only way.
I know that, I don't think it's on screen in 63 Up, but in the New York Times article, I think Jackie, who you and she have had one of the more contesting relationships, says she wouldn't want to sit across from anyone else and answer those questions.
Well, there you are. That's possible. Because, you know, we do have a good relationship, because I'm not pushy. I mean, I'm pushy when I'm making a film or doing something like that. When can I move on and all
right,
that.
Right, we're losing the light.
Yeah, all that. But it's been a great run, and I've been so... lucky with it, things have fallen into place at the right time. General elections have helped me and stuff like that, so I can't complain.
No, it's an amazing, I mean, I look forward to it every time. My wife, the last thing she said when I was leaving to come to the studio, she said, tell him thank you.
You took long enough to do it, didn't you?
Tell him thank you. She said it's something she looks forward to every 7 years. And there's millions like her, I'm sure.
Yeah. So it's all on DVD.
Yeah, one can go find all of them at this point, right? So again, the film is 63 Up. The website is 63upfilm.com. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. All one word, a world that just might work. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus 8 or so articles I choose each week to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes and most of the other podcast sites where you can find it. The archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, @McNallyTerrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell, Kiana Williams, and Teddy Robinson in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Finally, thank you, Michael Apted.
Great pleasure.
It has been a pleasure.
Thank you.